I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Holden Caulfield said it for all time in the opening paragraph of J.D. Salinger's masterpiece, The Catcher in the Rye. He said, "My parents would have about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father." Our guest, Margaret Salinger, has broken the family rule with her new memoir about growing up with her father. Her book is called Dream Catcher. She shows her father as a man who kept her mother a virtual prisoner in their home in Cornish, New Hampshire, a man who embraced a sequence of exotic religious practices, a man who built a separate house from his wife and children down the road so that he could write 12 hours a day. Margaret Salinger's book is really 2 books. One is a meticulous history and picking apart of the codes that her father chose to live by. The other book is a very close reading of his stories that is entirely emotional, providing a sort of autobiographical key to a great deal of her father's fictional creation. Perhaps his second book really is the authentic Salinger biography. He once told a graduate student who wanted to do an interview and profile, he said, "The biographical facts you want are in my stories in one form or another, including the traumatic experiences you asked about." Connection listeners, in your own close reading of J.D. Salinger, have you imagined a portrait of America's most famous recluse? Do you want to hear the real story as told by his daughter? And how does the cruel, flawed, or distasteful life of an artist affect his work? Or our judgment of it, too? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Catcher in the Rye connection. 1-800-423-TALK. You can join the conversation online also at theconnection.org. Margaret Salinger, welcome. Or should I call you Peggy?
Peggy's fine. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Absolutely fascinating book. Thoroughly worth writing, reading, and talking about, in my humble opinion. But difficult. This is a book about a father who's also an artist and will be known forever, perhaps, as the creator of Holden Caulfield. To me, that's the most interesting thing here, is to find how much of Holden Caulfield is a kind of spiritual, emotional autobiography of J.D. Salinger, and to go from there. Holden Caulfield, who lived his life in dread and contempt of phonies of the Ivy League, of pretension, what does that, I mean, that word phony, that dismissal, that anger, which is also a sense of rejection, is the word we remember Holden Caulfield by. What does it tell you? What are you telling us is the meaning of it in the life of J.D. Salinger?
I think about 5 different points come out of that long question. I was actually less interested in looking at his life in order to better understand his books. I really was coming at it from the reverse. I was using his books as primary source material to understand who he is. For me, the jury's really out on the discussion of whether it's important to know anything about the real life of a writer in order to appreciate his stories. And actually, one of my hopes in writing this was that people would go on reading his books, that none of the great affection with which they may remember reading Catcher in the Rye as a child would be in any way diminished, and that new generations of people would read them. It was really not my intent to criticize in any way his work, but rather to demythologize the person, the human being that wrote them.
And why demythologize him? He's a myth maker, after all.
Well, because several reasons. I think, first of all, anytime you put someone up on a pedestal, you're dehumanizing them. And in a sense, you're dehumanizing yourself. I think it's an unhealthy relationship, which strikes me much as guru and acolyte when you project your wishes onto somebody for perfection or for moral guidance, rather than looking to yourself and to your own and listening to your own God, your own gut, your own whatever your pleasure that it is you listen to. I find that, throughout my life, the kind of reaction I get from people, oh my God, he's your father. It's sort of like someone on the internet wrote, how dare she write this? J.D. Salinger is Jesus Christ and Buddha all wrapped up into one. And I don't think that that is a healthy place for the reader to be in or for my father to be in. And not just this singular case of J.D. Salinger, but in general, that kind of guru acolyte relationship is not a healthy one.
You think he's put himself on the pedestal and worshipped himself in a fashion?
Well, I don't know if he's put himself on a pedestal. He certainly has made his work and has acknowledged this as a goal into a sacred task, that there would be no separation between his life and his work, and it would be a sacred undertaking. So one certainly could say, here's a classic case of rampant blooming narcissism, or look at it as one person's religious quest. There are many ways to look at that
There are
attempt.
indeed. I just want to confess right straight up that I root for your father in this book, although I admire your writing and your search too. But it seems to me
How
what,
so?
well, it seems to me he's doing the work that artists have always done. What Henry James called the alchemy of art. He's transforming a life into something new, something James felt almost, it is a kind of creation of life. And it's very, very difficult. It's very, very demanding. And he undertook it, it seems to me, as a vocation, something of a mad exercise, but with enormous discipline and the highest goals. And it also seems to me clear in rereading Catcher in the Rye and your quotation from the many other stories, he did it very, very well. This prose is going to last. These stories are
Yes.
going to last.
Oh, yes.
He addressed the problem of sort of human pain and suffering, his own woundedness and need, with an ambition to create something beautiful and lasting. You approach it in the form of something that's at least suspiciously pathological and something to be healed and cured and talked about until we understand it. His is the artist's approach. Yours is the memoirist's approach, very much more in resonance with a kind of therapeutic culture, but his is a noble undertaking, seems to me.
Well, I think that there is something to be said for someone devoting themselves to their art, to a cause, to saving the world. And yet, I also think that it's not fair to have it both ways. I definitely think there is a place for celibacy in this world. And if you are responsible, if you take the responsibility for bringing children into this world, if you take the responsibility not just for falling in love, but for actively pursuing someone, and then claim absolute right to hermetic solitude, there's something, to borrow a rather famous word, there's something phony. There's something hypocritical about that. about artists who, on the one hand, want to devote themselves entirely to their art, and yet on the other hand, it's sort of wanting to have your cake and eat it too, expecting the responsibilities to your family to somehow, that you're absolved somehow because you're striving for a higher goal. And I've seen that. I've done some work in chaplaincy, and you see it again and again, not just with artists, not just with your people who you imagine are the sort of stereotypical narcissists, investment bankers, whatever have you, but people in the helping professions can be the worst. They can be out there saving the world and neglecting their home. And that's what I was taking issue with.
Well, surely it's a human failing of a man who aimed perhaps impossibly high. And surely also the life of the families around great artists is often unenviable. There are a lot of artists out there who were monsters at home, including the greatest ones. I mean, Tolstoy perhaps was the hardest husband and maybe father too that we know in literature. Go back to the big intention in the book. What did you want us to know about J.D. Salinger that drove you to the relentless kind of inquiry in the book?
Can I first address just the tail end of what you had said about Tolstoy? I think there's a difference between these men you've mentioned who were not particularly nice to live with. They were not viewed by the public. People did not make holy pilgrimages to them.
To Tolstoy, I think they did.
Expecting them to be the one person who would understand them and the one person with a high moral ground.
Yeah, I think.
Really?
And to be saintly.
Okay, okay.
There's the other type, though, and Henry James is one who in his bones felt that you couldn't live a life and produce the art that was his that was his gift and his
Fair
vocation.
Enough.
Johannes Brahms the same way.
Mm-hmm.
A man essentially without a life and a prodigious artistic production, and I'm sure he consciously chose the art over the life. There is a case to be made there. But
please,
go
please,
back
please
to
the
picture of your father.
Yes.
What is it you most wanted us to know about this creator?
I think perhaps the thing that I most wanted people to come away with is to back up just a little bit. I had read in the Globe a couple of years ago, actually, that a group of high school students went on a pilgrimage, and a reporter got wind of this to go. They had read Catcher in the Rye in their high school class, and the reporter asked one of the girls, "What would you have asked J.D. Salinger had you met him?" And she said, "I want to know if he would still be our catcher." Our catcher in the rye.
Yeah, explain that, what he meant by that.
Well,
in the story,
Phoebe, Holden's little sister, asks him what he would like to, what you know, sort of, what are you going to do with your life? What would you like to be when you grow up? And he said, "Well, all I'd like to do is I'd like to be on this." And I'm not quoting directly. I'm paraphrasing, but I'd like to. There'd be this whole field of children. No one would be around, no one big except me. And all the children would be playing in the rye, and it was at the edge of some crazy cliff, as he put it. And when one of the children would get too close, that's what I'd do, I'd catch them.
Hmm.
And I'd be the catcher in the rye. That's really all I'd want to do. And I had 2 points, really, to make about that. First of all, he won't be your catcher. People would say to me, "You know, oh, it must be so amazing having J.D. Salinger as your father." Well, there were some things that were amazing about it, and some very wonderful things. But to assume that in reality he will be your catcher is a fallacy, and perhaps that'll lead to fewer people going up and bothering him. I mean, maybe he'll at least have that. The other point about that passage is, it's a lovely idea for a young boy to have. When I read that passage as a mother, I was outraged. I said, you know, where are these children's parents? Why are they being allowed to play so close to the edge of a cliff? Why hasn't there been a safe place built for them to play, so that young people like Holden, and very much like, you know, myself in my own life, aren't in constant, having to be on a constant alert to catch people from falling over a cliff.
Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Peggy Salinger, daughter of J.D. Salinger, has written Dreamcatcher, a memoir. And it's more than that. It's a deep inquiry into the nature of art, the nature of human personality, how he was formed, what part of it was transmuted, how truly into his work, and the price that a lot of people around him paid for this. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation. I want to say again, I feel great sympathy for something he's trying to do here, including a code he has, his Ten Commandments, in effect. He knew he was doing something difficult, and he had considered it. But for example, one of his rules, and it comes up both in his fiction and apparently in his dinner table dicta: "Thou shalt not dabble in the arts unless you're born a genius."
Mm-hmm.
"Thou shalt not study religion unless in sackcloth at the foot of a foreign guru." "Thou shalt not be flawed."
Yes.
What do these things tell you? And again, you see ambiguity or hypocrisy in some of them, but what credit do you give just to the ideas, the goals themselves?
I think that they are goals that are certainly not my own. God knows I'm a perfectionist in certain ways. And that has both served me well and inhibited me. And I think there's, I have very little patience for sloppy art and workmanship, and can be rather annoying on the subject if, you know, were you to ask my husband. However, I think that it really is, one remains in the world of a child when one sees things always in black and white. Mm. For my father, people either all good or all bad. Something is either absolutely, I think John Leonard said it best in his review on CBS Sunday Morning. He said, "My father was a serial true believer." I wish I had said that.
It's good. Yeah. Can I just translate it? He reminds me of Ted Williams, the ball player, the last human being to hit 400 in the big leagues. Ted Williams, I think.
I love Ted Williams.
What did your dad think of him?
Well, once again, my parents were at loggerheads. My father rooted for Whitey Ford, and my mother rooted for Ted Williams.
But see, your father has that. Ted Williams was very censorious of other people. This is serious business, hitting a baseball. Get going. You know, make something, do it well, do it perfectly, and pay the price. John Updike wrote that wonderful piece about him in The New Yorker, and Ted Williams met him years later, and basically what he said was, you know, you've got talent, young man. You could do something serious with your life, like you could save the Atlantic salmon. Don't waste your time. And I hear that in your father's voice, too. I mean, like, life is hard. Art is a great aspiration.
Yes. I think it's a matter of degree. I respect those goals up until they become absolutist, where anything that's less than perfect is a source of huge shame and should be destroyed or eliminated. I don't think that leads to the kind of world I would like to live in. The consequences of that kind of thinking, you eliminate the contamination from your midst.
Well, let's grant that there's a certain, loony quality to some of these commandments. Among the later ones, thou shalt not set foot in the unclean Ivy League, and for God's sake, for Father's sake, never, ever take an English class. Thou shalt not do anything unless it's perfect. Thou shalt not be flawed. Thou shalt not be woman. Thou shalt not grow up.
Mm-hmm.
These are the domestic commandments of the great J.D. Salinger. 1-800-423-8255. His daughter Margaret is our guest. Her memoir is called Dream Catcher. Chester is on the line.
Hi. Actually, you just said some things that surprised me, like thou shalt not be woman, which hadn't struck me before. But I think that J.D. Salinger, at least in my life, I was a hippie, and I think that he set the precedent for the entire movement that became the hippie movement, because it's so personal, personal is such a good word, I can't go beyond that.
How do you get from Holden Caulfield to hippiedom?
Well, Holden Caulfield was the perfect, I'm really bad at this now, I could be articulate if I were, you know, studying this for a few minutes.
The perfect what, Peggy Salinger?
Okay. The epitome of self-indulgence, and at the same time the epitome of self-control. He was so much of an opposite in everything he thought and everything he did that he epitomized our generation. And, of course, you know, Peggy's father is the epitome of an earlier generation, my father's generation. Actually, not my father's.
Stand by. I want to give Peggy a chance. What does Holden epitomize, Peggy?
Oh, God, I don't know. I think, well, yes, I actually do. And the listener is quite right. It takes a minute to collect one's thoughts. So
collect your thoughts. I think he epitomizes a kind of alienation that I'm not sure I have ever experienced. In any event, you're listening to The Connection. What does he epitomize, Peggy Salinger?
I think my father has done a wonderful, extraordinary job in capturing the kind of borderline aspects of adolescence, how much things matter, how much things are divided into good guys and bad guys. And that's very simplistic, but I think any book that captures a period of life so well is bound to live on, and occasionally live on inappropriately. When you still have 30 and 40-year-olds thinking, you know, carrying the catcher in the rye in their back pocket as a guide for life, there again, it gets back to your question about perfectionism. I think part of maturing is being able to say, I don't like some of the things you do, but I do love you, to another human being. And that is not the case with Holden. It's not the case with most teenagers. It's not the case with my father. If he doesn't like something, anything that you do, I don't mean joining the Nazi party, but if you happen to like an artist that he doesn't like, he can't love you.
One strike, you're out.
Yes.
1-800-423-8255, the J.D. Salinger Connection with his daughter Margaret. Pat is on the line.
Hey, Chris and Peg, what's up?
Hey, we are.
You're up, man.
You guys are going to love this, right? I read the book when I was back in last 2 years of high school. I went to boarding school, And, you know, that was one of our required reading. And, you know, I don't see what the big deal is about the book. Peg, you hit the nail on the head when you just said, you know, about using it as a guide to put in your back pocket to get you through life. I mean, I don't see what the big deal is. Like, it almost seems as if some people are just like jump on a bandwagon and say, you know, they love this book just because, like, so many, like, it's like a trend or something. Like, girlfriend loves it. I'm not saying, you know, she's like that. Maybe some people really do like it. I'm sure they do. But I don't, you know, it seems like there's just, I don't see what the real big deal is about the book. I struggled to get through it. You know, I skip pages here and there. I see the symbolic meaning that has, but, you know, I just don't see what the big deal is.
Listen up.
I think, It's one of those books that seems to either grab people or go right on by. I read it in my late 20s, and I thought it was a really good book, but it didn't send me as it didn't. I think I read it too late.
I put it to Connection listeners. When did you read Catcher in the Rye? Did it send you? What pocket do you carry it in?
Oh,
what does it mean? 1-800-423-8255. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the J.D. Salinger Connection with his daughter, Margaret Salinger, who's written a memoir of life with the famous author, the famous reclusive author of The Catcher in the Rye and those famous stories of the Glass family, the Franny and Zooey stories, that were sort of the beginning of post-war American fiction in the late 40s and mid-50s. 1-800-423-8255. Why did he move to Cornish, New Hampshire, at the beginning of his great success? What was that all about? And I wish you'd sort of fill in the picture, Peggy, of this habit. It happened many times of isolating people, fixing on people, preying on people. It begins to seem. What was this all about?
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist. All I could do was tell a story and tell a story of what I found out, what I tried very much not to do in the book. I tried very much to come about it as an historian, someone using the material I learned and knew about, making connections that I saw, but not saying, boiling it down to saying, this trauma led to X, and simplifying it in that manner. So it's within that context that my comments I would hope would be taken, rather than as sort of an armchair psychiatrist.
But then what is going on here?
I think he really wanted, I know he and his sister, when he had a little bit of money in his pocket from the publication of The Catcher in the Rye, took a drive out into the country to find some place where he could work and live in peace. And that dream is straight out of The Catcher. I mean, our house in Cornish, I mean, when you read what Holden dreams of, his little place that's partway in the sunshine and where, you know, he asks Sally Hayes, I think it is, to run, a girl he doesn't even like very much, to run away with him, and we'd have children and hide them away and teach them how to read and write ourselves. And again and again, I would find my mother stepping into his the play he'd written for his life, that reality would sort of form out of the stuff of fantasy. And there you have it. There we are in Holden's cabin.
What more broadly do you think was going on in this recurrent kind of relationship with women? It was always... he was drawn to a certain Gigi, Leslie Caron movie image of younger women. At the same time, he also seemed to give them a kind of warning, fair warning or not, that he might have been a monk, that he wasn't really interested in a complete family life, too. There were many different signals there.
I have come to believe, and I think that intelligent people can disagree on this, but when I heard my mother's story for the first time, and then read Joyce Maynard's memoir, the two of them had never spoken, and also read the stories of his, pardon me, female characters, I was shocked by the degree to which these young women were characters. They were almost mirrors, echoes of his imagination of what he wished to be. And when people say, oh, what about Salinger's little girls? I think it's much more interesting to look at it from, you know, a less base point of view and realize that you have to be quite young and also, I think, quite, if not damaged, certainly not have a strong sense of self in order to become that sort of blank slate for someone to, that you really have to be welcomed into his world. And where the relationships would fall apart was anywhere they diverged. I mean, he would tell me a story. I can't tell you the many times he would tell me the story of, you know, him being on a date with a woman and she laughed at some bit of slapstick in the movie. And I mean, you might have thought she was saying Heil Hitler. He said, oh God. And, you know, I was through with her. I think it takes, there are not too many mature women who can be a projection of someone's fantasy in the way a young woman can, a young, insecure woman can. Girl, really.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Salinger connection with Margaret Salinger, who's written the book Dream Catcher, about her famous father, J.D. Salinger. Eric is on the line.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, Eric.
Good morning to both of you.
For all of you.
I've got a newborn, and I'm going to walk away for just a second and let my wife take over.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about some of your father's other works. I think everyone on the show's been fixated a little bit on Catcher in the Rye, which is a great book, don't get me wrong, but I've always been taken with a lot of the short stories, particularly nine stories.
Yes.
And so I'm curious if you could comment on your reactions to those. I'm guessing that you read them all and have some reactions.
Yes.
And second, young children play such a crucial role in your father's stories, particularly Phoebe in Catcher in the Rye, and, for example, Esme in For Esme with Love and Squalor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know if, as a young child growing up, you had feelings that your father treated you and other children with such a reverence.
Two very interesting questions. I think I'll answer the second one first, since it's freshest in my mind. Yes, time and again, the savior of the young man who is in pain in these books is a 10-year-old.
Hmm.
Phoebe's 10. Esme is a little bit older than that. Holden's younger brother, who died when he was 10. Teddy is 10 on the day of his death in Nine Stories. Maddie in his stories of Babe, an older brother, and his younger sister Maddie is 10. These, don't be surprised if you don't recognize these names, which you have to go delving through.
Yes, Eric, she has read the story
of the library to get the unpublished, the ones that appear in older magazines. And I think there certainly was in my own life a tremendous pressure to be the perfect 10-year-old. And there's a chapter in my book that's entitled A Perfect 10. I have much more to say about that, but let me go on to your first question about the Nine Stories. Hands down, I like his short stories by far the best of his work. And my favorite is a story called For Esme with Love and Squalor. And what I found fascinating in the course of my research, I'm probably sending scores of people off to libraries, which isn't a bad thing, is that For Esme begins with a man in England about to leave. He's a counterintelligence officer, as was my father, preparing for D-Day, as was my father. The story then goes silent. It picks up again right after VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, and this young man is vomiting into a wastebasket. And the story never talks about what happened in between. It falls silent. What happened to this man? The sort of daddy, what did you do in the war? Mm. What I was fascinated to find out in looking at his old stories, his war stories in the magazines that were never published in book form, is that part of his war experience was indeed written about, beautifully written about. Mm. In the character of Babe Gladwaller.
Yep.
Gladwaller, I think. And his family, who actually Babe and Vincent Caulfield are best buddies and army mates. And Vincent's younger brother, Holden, in one of the stories, is found missing in action.
Mm. The fragments of the war stories, which I read in your book, were just beautiful, I thought.
Yes.
Eric, did you want to follow up?
No, that's terrific. Thank you very much for offering the insight. It's wonderful to hear from you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. Mike is in upstate New York.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, I'm just wondering, what reaction, if any, did J.D. Salinger have with all the negative publicity after Mark David Chapman had shot John Lennon, and really, you know, the negative mystique that seems to surround the book. Even a few years ago, the movie Conspiracy Theory featured the book. Just wondering, what were his...
Did he react to the Mark David Chapman?
I don't know if there was a reaction. I do, though, have quite a strong feeling on that subject. And I feel there's a great difference between someone who writes beautifully about adolescence and therefore appeals to a certain segment of very borderline grown men who then use this book to go off and, eliminate the world of phonies in a very misguided way. I do not feel he has any responsibility or any reason to feel guilt. It's not like writing a book that incites people to violence. This is not a KKK manual. This is not a manual that in any way justifies, except to a very sorry and confused mind, the acts that many of these people have perpetrated.
Fair enough. Point taken. Mike, thank you. 1-800-423-TALK makes the Salinger connection. Stephen is on the line. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Welcome.
I am the editor of Salinger.org, and I'm not sure if Peggy has heard of us.
I'm afraid I haven't. I use my computer as a word processor.
I'm not surprised, and I don't blame you.
What's on the page, Stephen?
Well, basically, years ago, I discovered that there were other Salinger stories that were not published in book.
Yes.
And I, searched them out and wrote up a list of them and put them on the Internet, in the early, in 1994, which I guess was pretty early in the World Wide Web. I got such a strong reaction that I ended up, just continuing this with a discussion list and all sorts of things on the Internet. And it's funny. One thing that I've noticed recently is that in the early days, I used to get calls all the time from people wanting to know how to get a hold of him. And they would say, he's my hero. Mm. I really want to get a hold of him and ask him a question. Or, can't you tell me more about his life or something? Because I never put anything about Salinger the man, just Salinger the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Just publication information and, articles and things like that. Nothing too exciting. And now I'm suddenly noticing, and at the time, also, the family had been entirely silent and protected. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, with Joyce's and your book, I'm noticing that the family is opening up, and I'm starting to get people calling me a phony for posting anything and saying, don't you think that you shouldn't even have any kind of a website because Salinger wouldn't approve? And it's like suddenly the fans are becoming as protective as the family used to be, and the family is opening up, and I'm wondering, what caused that?
I think you bring up a really interesting question about loyalty. And I think that it's something that people can have a very knee-jerk reaction that, everyone should protect his privacy or his secrecy, and anyone who doesn't is being disloyal. But I think loyalty is a much more complex issue. For example, the act that probably brought down the most ire was Joyce Maynard selling my father's letters. But I really felt, should she take these letters that she came by honestly and put them in a reliquary like a saint's little finger and have loyalty to these, or does she owe more loyalty to the children she has brought into this world who have certain realities to deal with, like college tuition? I think that people are too quick to simplify what one should or should not do. And if you're having questions about what you should put on your website, I think that's for you to decide, not for someone else.
Can I just say, the one mystery that I think is really interesting is whether he's been writing all these years, whether this vocational, incredibly disciplined, determined writer, who hasn't published since the 60s, is going to leave a great tome of new work.
Well, certainly 15 years ago, he took me back into his office, which was probably the second time I'd ever seen his study, and showed me, he was delighted with this new filing system that he had, and he had a red dot on stories that were ready to go should he die, upon his death. A green meant these require some editing.
Stand by, Peggy Salinger.
Oh, sorry.
You're listening to The Connection. It's a wonderful scene in the book where you didn't even want to look to see what the words actually said on those pages.
Oh, yes, when I was a very little girl and I'd visit his study in the woods. That's one of the things, children pick things up with, wonderful antennae.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as if, I had some mean father saying, don't look at anything on the walls. I just...
You knew.
You,
but has he been writing all these
eyes.
Years? Is there more
Salinger
to
come? Absolutely. That's what I was saying about, the filing system. That he has been writing every day, barring, illness or what have you.
When will we see that work?
Your guess is as good as mine. He's planning to publish after his death. But whether he does or not is anyone's guess.
1-800-423-TALK, the J.D. Salinger connection with his daughter, Margaret. Leah is on the line.
Hi, I'm Danish, and I read it many, many years ago when I was 17, and my immediate reaction was, this is a phony. This, nobody feels this way. It's put on paper in order to make yourself important. Later on, I came here to this country, and I taught English as a second language to people with all sorts of backgrounds, and we read Catcher in the Rye, and I found that some had the same reaction as I, this is American in the bad American way, and others were captivated. And I was wondering, does anyone know what the reaction, I'm sure it has been translated to all possible languages, is there something uniquely American about this view that Salinger has?
Interesting question, Leah. Thank you. Margaret Salinger.
Yes, it. I actually have had some friends doing a bit of a bit of surveillance in foreign countries, and it is clearly not uniquely American, which actually surprised me. They several friends of mine who travel a lot for business and are quite literary as well have said that in Germany and in France in particular, it's a whole huge thing again among the young people. That, you know, over here you see a couple of his books, you know, crammed into the great book section. There are piles and tables of The Catcher in the Rye. So it's speaking to a whole new generation of Germans and French children. I mean, sorry, adolescents at this point.
Leah, thank you. Gina is on the line.
Hi, good morning. I am a two-time Thou Shalt Not Salinger transgressor, both as a woman and an English teacher. My feeling is we have all of our freshmen read Catcher in the Rye, and I wonder whether your father would have liked that, because it does become institutionalized in a sense, but the importance of that particular reading assignment for me is that is the most powerful way in which we can say to those rooms filled with little Holden Caulfields, we embrace you, we recognize you with your confusion, your rebellion, and your alienation, and you are the people whom we want to teach. You don't have to not be Holden Caulfield, and in a way, you know, maybe we actually are their catchers.
Margaret, is that a fair reading?
Well, first of all, I wasn't quite clear. Are you teaching freshmen in college or freshmen in high school?
I teach high school.
Oh, good. Because I think that's...
That's a lesser sin than teaching.
No, not a lesser sin. Not at all. I just think that that's a much better time, especially with our kids growing up so much more quickly than in past generations.
But is that the way to teach it?
Well, I don't think there is a way to teach it. Certainly, it depends on how you teach. I mean, there's ways where, you know, many teachers present a book and get people to think about it and sort through their own thoughts. There are other teachers who want you to regurgitate what they think. So if you're a good teacher, you're probably doing a great job.
I know you haven't heard from your father about this. I know he didn't want you to write it. Is there anything in this book that he might not be able to forgive you for? I would hope you'd talk about it with him someday. What do you think?
I don't think that he has the same priorities that we do. A little sin is the same as a large one. So looking for what will really make him angry is, I think looking in the, that's not the sort of person he is.
I loved reading it. Margaret Salinger, thank you for Dreamcatcher. Thank you for joining us on The Connection.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Emerson Hospital, providing routine and advanced medical and surgical care for families in more than 25 communities. On the web at emersonhospital.org. By Cleo's Restaurant and Private Dining.